Mr. Radowski, do you need any accommodation or help?
I'm okay. I've got just surgery on my...
All right. If you need us to...
Well, but I'm
bring a bottle
I'm
of water there or something. All right. When you've got your papers ready, whenever.
Appreciate that. David Radowski, to the appellant, reserve a 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Great.
The issue on this appeal is one of standing of the plaintiffs, NAACP, Delaware, and six individuals to secure prospective relief on their challenge to the policies and practices of the Wilmington Police Department that violate the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act.
How come there was no suit for damages here? Why was there no suit for damages in addition to...
There was no claim for damage in this case. This is simply for prospective relief going forward. And the question becomes then, do they have standing based on their own history, which I will get into, on organizational, associational standing?
Right. The individual plaintiffs collide directly with Lyons. I don't see how their claims can survive.
Let me start with that argument first. I was going to start with the organizational issue, but let me address the Lyons issue on the individual plaintiffs. We have six individual plaintiffs subjected to stops without cause, several of whom were stopped more than once, two or three times. They were innocent individuals. None of them were engaged on pleadings. None of them were engaged in any criminal activity. They were stopped, they were searched, and they were arrested. And on a motion to dismiss, the court has to accept the allegations here, and it's not disputed, that it was all based on their race. They were black residents of Wilmington. They were stopped randomly. They were searched. They were frisked. They were detained based on discrimination only. Lyons is not controlling for several reasons. Number one, Mr. Lyons was involved in criminal activity. He resisted. The police used a chokehold. He then sued. He had a damage claim, which the court accepted. He then sued as well for prospective relief, and the court, 5-4, disagreed with it, but there was a rationale there. They said for him to have standing, he's got to show likelihood that he would be subjected to a chokehold again in the future. That would require him to commit another criminal act as an individual and for the police to respond, a different police officer, to use a chokehold, right?
How can they plead a reasonable likelihood that these individuals are going to face this again? It seems
right.
To be
so for these individuals, the point is that they were all involved in innocent activity, and several courts have made that point very clearly, including Judge Ambrose in Hassan versus New York City. That's a template for this case. Hassan versus New York City was a case
that was continuing surveillance
involving the religious discrimination after 9/11. Where Muslims were targeted for stops.
I'm sorry, Judge Ambrose asking.
I'm sorry.
That there was continuing surveillance in that case.
I'm sorry?
There was continuing surveillance in that case, correct?
Right. There was, but your opinion said, whether it's religious discrimination or racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination, that opens the door to standing because you have people who were being stopped indiscriminately, not for criminal activity.
But then you still run into the same problems that you have in Lyons and in O'Shea and in Rizzo, that you have to have imminent danger of it happening to these people in the future.
But here's the point. On a motion to dismiss, it's different. Lyons was a preliminary injunction. As with some of the other cases,
you still have to assure
the burden is different
of standing and rightness here. And you know, I don't see what you've pled that shows that there's this imminent that it's right that if we don't intervene.
You have six individual plaintiffs, several of whom were stopped more than once, and so you've got that pattern. And what the Supreme Court has made clear after Lyons was dated somewhat, that if you can show that there's a pattern, it's a Monell kind of claim, that there's a pattern of officially sanctioned unconstitutional practices, which...
Well,
All these stops were unconstitutional.
Sorry, Mr. Rudofsky.
Yes.
The judge gets asked.
No, that's okay. A pattern of practice that follows up on the policy of the police department. And is there a policy that you know? Yes, we have a safe streets program, but what is the pattern or practice that follows a policy of the police department in terms of these particular six individuals?
It doesn't have to be under Monell a written policy. If it's a practice that's alleged, and that's exactly what we allege here, that they have a practice of stopping black residents here, whether they were in cars, not doing anything illegal, whether they're walking down the streets, not doing anything illegal, all completely innocent activity.
Okay, Mr. Rudofsky, let's assume we disagree with you and we think Lyons or Chambers are controlling. The associational standing rises or falls with the individual ones because the association, set-aside organizational, has no greater or lesser standing than its individual component.
That's right. We only have to show whether it's organizational, associational, or individual standing. Mm-hmm. This is one of three prongs of arguments we have. We think we make this case here. And if you look at the Shaw versus Smith case, that recent 10th Circuit case, which was just decided, it's in our reply brief, this was targeted stops of a discrete group of out-of-state drivers by the Kansas police, passengers and so on, for alleged traffic violations, leading what the court said likely to lead to future stops of this minority group. That is, they were targeting people coming in from out-of-state licenses. That was a minority group, not race or religion or ethnicity, just because they were from another state, many of whom had not violated the laws at all. And what the court said was that those violations, it's likely, if we don't enjoin them, are likely to continue. And that's even without a race or religious basis for the discrimination.
Okay, Mr. Rudofsky, you said you had wanted to start with organizational standing, and then certainly if my colleagues want to talk about the others, we can talk more, but I do want to hear what you have to say about organizational standing. This seems to get us to this, you know, a Lyons versus Hibbins Realty, and it seems like you are asking us to read, to really rely on Hibbins Realty here. Can we ask, what you agree is the scope of alliance? Are you disputing that alliance precludes standing based on spending, based on resource diversion, and based on difficulty accomplishing a mission?
Yeah, so everybody agrees that what alliance stands for is just because you have an ideological difference with the government policy does not give you standing.
And also, just because you want to spend money to further the ideological mission, that's not enough, correct?
That's right. And what
how about just because you divert resources towards this ideological mission as opposed to others? You're nodding, you agree that's not enough.
That's right. And
okay, then how about difficulty accomplishing a mission? You're going to get in the way of fulfilling our ideological mission. That's not enough.
Certainly not enough. Okay,
are you making an argument about core business activity? Go ahead.
The core mission of NAACP, as we allege and set forth very specifically in the complaint, it's engaged and continues to be engaged. The district court read this as past activity and therefore not sufficient. They engage and continue to be engaged in educating the black community to protect itself and to publicize police misconduct, engage in protests of racially motivated acts and by the Wilmington Police Department, and promotion of effective accountability measures.
That sounds to me like you've just repackaged the spending, the resource diversion, and difficulty accomplishing the mission that you just agreed weren't enough.
No, because what they've been doing for decades, right, not only in Wilmington but in the entire state, is that's their core mission. It's been made more difficult because now what the Wilmington Police Department has done, and again, this is not disputed and on a motion to dismiss, they have created a new system, right, of randomly stopping drivers, pedestrians, subjecting them to searches and detentions, all innocent people without cause. And now what the NAACP has to do is to get involved in those cases as well. It increases their expenses.
That's a resource diversion or spending argument or difficulty accomplishing mission. What activity was NAACP unable to do because the defendant, quote, directly affected and interfered with it?
It requires the NAACP now, which has limited resources. They are across the state. They've been doing this work. The core mission is race discrimination, discrimination of any kind in Delaware. Now you have, in the last couple of years, as alleged, a new policy practice of the Wilmington Police Department. They're covering it up. They're not recording stops. There's all kinds of evidence that what they're doing now is kind of randomly deciding we are going to deter crime, right, by randomly stopping cars only of black residents. All these stops, 99% of black residents in Wilmington.
What is the Safe Streets program? What is its...
So the allegation here is a special unit that's been set up, right?
Okay.
That is kind of this anti-crime unit that has special
powers and enforcement. Is there any evidence in the complaint, or any allegation in the complaint, that the special unit actually stopped the six individuals?
That's exactly correct. Several of whom were stopped, you know,
by the people in that select unit.
And it's not only six; it's many people who were stopped. We're talking about the individual, you know, lions issue here. We're talking about a practice that exposes in the future every black resident in Wilmington, whether they're engaged in completely innocent activity or not, to these random stops. That's the key to this. In terms of organizational standing, how does NAACP now have to respond to that, right? Aside from this lawsuit and everything else that we brought, they've now got to spend, draw efforts and people from other parts of the state.
What you're saying is that any time the NAACP, in fulfilling its mandate, bringing a suit, that somehow it has organizational standing because it has to spend money to bring that suit on behalf of others.
No, it's not the suit. It's the other activity doing it. What the suit alleges is exactly that. And there are
every time you spend money on this suit, you're maybe not spending it on the next suit that comes in. I mean, you can see why Alliance says you got to go more than that.
And so there are two circuit opinions after Alliance that support our position. Number one, in the Fourth Circuit, Republican National Committee. And this is really interesting, right? What is this suit? There was a suit brought against North Carolina by the Republican National Committee. And the question was whether they had standing to challenge North Carolina law, which they said was inconsistent with federal law because it allowed fraudulent voting.
The Fourth Circuit did say there was standing. I do think it's relevant that both parties were supporting standing. I'm not sure they had the benefit of as vigorous an adversarial presentation as we have here, or they had in the Fifth Circuit.
But the court itself said, we have to look at it, even if standing is not raised.
They did.
Had an independent duty to do it. They did it. And what they said was the Republican National Committee had a core mission of supporting Republican candidates and combating voter fraud. Well, if that's true there, right? And that was sufficient to create standing there.
But why should we follow the Fourth Circuit?
Well, that's
the Fifth Circuit en banc came out the other way, and the Fifth Circuit looks like it was reading a line for the credit.
I want to talk about that as well, but before I get to the en banc decision in U.S. versus Texas, The Ninth Circuit
following pre-Alliance precedent circuit.
No, it was post. It was an immigration challenge.
MDEF was post. But it was following pre-Alliance Ninth Circuit precedent.
Right. But that's right. But we think it was right even post-Alliance because what it required was this Remain in Mexico, a new program of the federal government.
The pre or post doesn't seem to make a difference in the Ninth Circuit case. Their facts were so different. They had to hire additional staff, increase travel to Mexico across the border, divert staff resources from other projects to continue this particular mission, and on and on. So that's not this case.
The reason it is this case is that NAACP, in the same way...
Did you have to hire additional staff?
They've got staff from other parts of the state to respond to the crisis in Wilmington. They've got limited resources in the same way that the immigration organization involved in NOAM had to now deal with this new program of remaining in Mexico.
Well, help me here. How do you cross the line so you don't have an alliance problem with respect to organizational standing?
I'm sorry?
When do you cross the line?
Okay, so let me talk about why what the line was crossed in both of those cases. And U.S. versus Texas is really interesting for this reason. U.S. versus Texas, if I could take 2 or 3 minutes on this. U.S. versus Texas was a lawsuit originally brought by the United States and organizations in Texas on the Supremacy Clause. Texas passed a statute which they said would kind of duplicate what the federal government did. Texas law enforcement could deport people, right, the Supremacy Clause notwithstanding. And what Texas said in response to that, to the challenge to that, is that there's no additional burdens on any organization that had been supporting undocumented people in the United States. This was, in effect, a coordination with the federal government. There would be no additional. They would do the same thing. They would challenge the deportation, whether it was state or federal. And again, this was on a what you've got is a 11-7 ruling by the Fifth
Circuit. Let's go back to the Fifth Circuit case for a moment. Following alliance, that you have if you have the core activity of providing ordinary legal representation, merely saying that that's what we're doing, and that seems to be what NAACP is doing here, that cannot be used to, Fifth Circuit's words, quote, invent, close quote, standing. And that seems to be following pretty clearly from alliance.
That's right. Yeah. And you've got a 7-judge dissent, which makes 2 important points. Number one, just on the merits, that they're wrong. Because, in fact, what Texas was saying is that no more resources are needed, no more money is needed, because these efforts by Texas simply sit on the same efforts that the United that the federal government was doing.
But don't you need to show some type of plus in beyond the core?
That's right.
Legal representation.
Right, in U.S. versus Texas, is the plus was that the majority got it wrong in saying there's simply an overlap here. There's a whole new system of jails, because when Texas is arresting people, it's not being sent to a federal institution. Now you've got scores of other jails that these organizations have to cover. That's the key. And here's the second point. This, again, was a preliminary injunction. And therefore, the plaintiffs had the burden of proof on a preliminary injunction, a high burden of proof, of showing that the state of Texas was wrong, right? That we would really have to cover all these other institutions. We're now on a motion to dismiss, where there's a very, very low level of showing what that is, given that you have to accept all the factual allegations as true. If this was a motion to dismiss in the Texas case, it would have come out the other way, because then the allegation that we have to cover all these state jails, not only the federal detention centers, would be valid. And so both on the merits and on the procedural posture, you have a very different type of situation, which is why, again, the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, I think, was right. On a motion to dismiss, all we have to show, as here, is that because of these new additional efforts in Wilmington, NAACP Delaware has to take other resources and, at this point, go with that. Final point is associational standing. And again, we briefed this. Associational standing, they have standing if they can show any of their members was adversely impacted by this. And the district court got it wrong by saying you've got to identify those members. There's no duty to identify it on a motion to dismiss. Earth Island and those cases make that clear. And so we're at least entitled, based on this is a statewide organization, discovery will show for summary judgment whether or not there are members who've been adversely impacted by this. If there is, that's an independent basis for standing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Radovsky. We'll get you back on rebuttal.
morning, Your Honors. Kelly Farnan from Richards, Leighton & Finger here today on behalf of the City of Wilmington, the Chief of the City of Wilmington Police Department, and the Mayor of the City of Wilmington. As you heard, the plaintiffs here seek solely declaratory and injunctive relief, and none of them have adequately pled a concrete, particularized, imminent harm sufficient to invoke the court's jurisdiction. And it's our position that correct application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent, including Rizzo, Lyons, Hippocratic Medicine, and Summers, would compel affirming the district court's decision here. And I'll start where you started with Mr. Radosky on individual standing for the individual plaintiffs. And Lyons and Rizzo really do control here. There's no dispute that in order to demonstrate Article III standing to seek forward-looking injunctive relief, each of them must show they're likely to suffer a concrete, particularized injury and that it is real and immediate, not conjectural and not hypothetical.
The allegations in the complaint is that the safe street officers are authorized not to use body cameras, and that is a continuing Wilmington Police Department policy. I thought that allegation moved the needle.
Not for a policy, Your Honor. And again, the Safe Streets program, while they've relied on it, if you look at paragraph 21 of the amended complaint where they describe it, and the district court relied on this, it's racially neutral. It's not talking about racial discrimination at all.
Paragraph 21 has its own problems by alleging somebody from the Dover Police Department.
Correct.
We'll skip that for the moment.
Correct. But that's where they talk about the Safe Street program, and Your Honor's correct. They rely on a case with the City of Dover Police Department because Safe Streets is used in places other than the City of Wilmington. It's not a racially motivated policy. There's no allegation that it is. And then importantly, I think Your Honor asked Mr. Radosky, do any of these individual plaintiffs actually allege interaction with the Safe Streets officers, and only one of them does. I think Mr. Radosky took some liberties with the allegations in the complaint. The only person who alleges Safe Streets is Samaj Gwynn, who says that he has two interactions with police, and he says they were with the department and with Safe Streets. It's not clear. But what he has is what is Rizzo case exactly. So he says he had two interactions with the police department. He believes both of them are racist. But Rizzo said that there was no standing there because the argument was based on what one of a small, unnamed minority of policemen might do to them in the future because of an unknown policeman's perception of departmental disciplinary procedures. There, the issue was whether officers would feel free to do something because they didn't think they would be disciplined. But the point is the same. Mr. Gwynn is the only one who talks about safe streets, and he talks about being confronted by the same officers twice. Again, that's exactly so. That doesn't give you standing. And what they really have here, I mean, the Lyons court was very clear that you have to allege not only that he would have another encounter with police, but also make the incredible assertion either that all police officers in Los Angeles always choke any citizen with whom they happen to have an encounter, or that the city ordered or authorized police officers to act in such a manner. We have nothing like that here. What we have are six different individuals who allege completely factually distinct fact patterns, six separate ones over the course of approximately 2 years, none of which have been shown to be likely to repeat themselves, and none of which are resulted from a racially discriminatory policy that's been identified. And on the point of the policy, I want to call out in particular paragraph 94 of the amended complaint, where they admit that the city's written policy is to not discriminate based on race. So and I would agree with Mr. Radosky, the policy does need to be written, but then you have to get into the realm of a pattern or practice that is so pervasive that it rises to the level of a policy. We have nothing like that here. And I think, again, you have to look at, there was a bit of a lumping in the argument, but the Supreme Court in Murphy was clear that standing is not dispensed in gross. So you've got to look at each six of these individuals. Are they likely to have another encounter with the City of Wilmington Police Department? And will they run into a discriminatory, unconstitutional policy? That has not been shown. We went over, again, there are six different disparate areas here. Two of them are home searches, where one, the officers came to the home because they had information that a probationer lived there. The second, they called 911 to the home because somebody was found unresponsive and eventually passed away.
What do they have to show? When does it cross the line in showing somebody who's been repeatedly arrested or dealt with unconstitutionally in the past and this person is fearful that it's going to happen in the future because it happened recently in the past, the most recent one. Does that cross the line? I mean, sometimes you could just say, well, it hasn't happened tomorrow. Why don't you stop fearful of tomorrow? Well, he might be fearful of tomorrow. So you're writing the opinion. What do you do to say when you apply Alliance or O'Shea or Rizzo, and when don't you?
I think the important part for all of those cases and for the facts here is you have to identify a policy that they might run into. So, and again, that it would arise from the fact pattern that mirrors their prior interaction with the officers. Murthy also says that the past injuries are only relevant for their predicted value. So, for example, if you take Ms. Trenka, or Trenega Charles, Ms. Charles, who called 911, what are the odds that she's going to call 911 again, and that something that then happens from there is going to be the result of a policy? In every instance where the courts have found standing, you have a policy, and you have somebody who fits the potential mold of that policy. And we just don't have either here. We've got six completely different factual scenarios. You've got to look at each of them individually. And no identified policy other than the written policy, which says do not discriminate based on race. And so you need to connect the two to actually have some imminence and not just hypothetical harm.
If you don't have hypothetically standing for the six individuals, do you have some type of organizational standing
for
NAACP Delaware?
No, we do not believe that the NAACP Delaware has organizational or associational standing. I think as Judge Bibas noticed, the associational standing would go away if they don't have any individual, and for additional reasons too, which I'll get to. But the organizational standing, Hippocratic Medicine case really controls that here. The Association for Hippocratic Medicine confirmed, one, an organization must meet the requirements. So they have to show an injury in fact, causation, and redressability. They have to show direct harm to themselves, the same level of imminence that's caused by a policy. But it made an important additional clarification that an organization...
If they had alleged damages in this case, would the addressability have been met? If the complaint had asked for damages in this case, would redressability have been met?
Well, we haven't challenged redressability necessarily thus far.
No, I'm just saying that's if.
I think it's possible. Yes, I think it's possible that it would, but I'm not sure they would still meet the injury. And I don't think they would meet the injury, in fact, and including the imminence requirements in order to have standing. So the Association for Hippocratic...
I'm saying damages would be, you would have... I was unconstitutionally harmed in the past. I'm asking for damages now. If they had done it, you would have standing, would you not?
If they could show unconstitutional harm in the past, the question. But yes, and then if they showed that they had damages, that would be a redressability. Our issue is, under Hippocratic Medicine, they can't show constitutional standing, injury in fact, because an organization cannot send its way into standing. And Hippocratic Medicine was very clear, and I do think that they are asking you to rely on Haven Realty for organizational standing. And Hippocratic Medicine was very clear that Haven Realty, the notion from that case that standing exists when an organization diverts its resources in response to a defendant's actions, is incorrect. That's what the Supreme Court said. So that is no longer a live way for them to seek organizational standing. And if you look at their reply brief on page 4.
How would you distinguish Alliance from Havens? Where would you draw the line?
I think what you have to do is look at what Alliance said about Havens. And Alliance said that we're not overruling it, but you have to look at it in its context, and you have to keep a cabin there. So Havens has a very narrow purpose in the law now, and that's what the Alliance case said. And if you look at
the informational injury statute, and Alliance mentioned that too.
Right. Havens is an informational injury statute. The other important thing is that At to Home, which is the organization that sought standing there, they only evaluated it not for injunctive relief, but only for monetary remedies. So I think that has to be considered. But then Hippocratic Medicine says the reason why Haven had standing was because Haven's actions her home had standing, was Haven's actions directly affected and interfered with Home's core business activities, not dissimilar to a retailer who sues a manufacturer for selling defective goods to the retailer. That's a very different thing than what we have here. And so I think all you can do with Haven's Realty is what the Supreme Court said, which is to keep it cabined to its particular facts, none of which are given rise to by the NAACP's arguments here. So I'll move on lastly to associational standing. As noted, if none of the individual plaintiffs have standing, there's no associational standing here, but there's an additional issue in the sense that they haven't identified a single member. And the Supreme Court's decision in Summers really controls that inquiry. There, the Supreme Court held that to establish associational standing, an organization must make specific allegations that at least one identified member had suffered or would suffer harm. They haven't identified a single member that has suffered harm that's sufficient to confer constitutional standing. And I think this court actually relied on Summers in the New Jersey physician's case and found there was no standing because they hadn't specifically identified a member. So for all those reasons, we would ask that you affirm the decision of the district court. Unless your honors have any questions, I don't have any further.
Thank you, Ms. Farnan.
Thank you.
Mr. Wardowski, you reserve some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me start with the associational standing, because there is a clear difference between Summers versus Earth Island, which was an appeal following a full trial. There was never any mention in that case that there was a requirement at the pleading stage on a motion to dismiss that any individual be identified by name. The allegation that there were such individuals was sufficient. That would go to discovery, it could go to summary judgment. And so that case clearly supports our position, as does Alabama Legislative Black Caucus. There again, case came up to the U.S. Supreme Court on a full record. They remanded for reconsideration of the membership list. That is, they sent it back to the court after that to see if there was evidence that there were at least one individual who was identified. And if there was, that establishes standing as a matter of law. We're still at the motion to dismiss stage. There could be discovery. All the membership lists will be provided. NAACP is a statewide organization. And in fact, the Supreme Court said in Alabama Legislative Black Caucus, with a large statewide organization, it is highly likely on remand that they're going to be able to show harm to at least a single member. So that's one path for standing, and that's all we need. Turning to organizational standing, they don't talk about the Fourth Circuit opinion. They don't talk about the Ninth Circuit. They don't talk about Republican National Committee, or the fact that in the Texas case, again, that was on a preliminary injunction where the plaintiffs had the burden of showing that the state was wrong, that what they were doing was just duplicative of the federal deportation, and it wouldn't require other resources. So both of those, even over a seven-judge dissent on the merits, is important. And therefore,
it seems like in the Fourth and the Ninth Circuit, there was a plus factor. The Republican National Committee Fourth Circuit case, the Ninth Circuit case, it seemed like the court was finding a plus factor in beyond its core business or core and business activity.
And I think that fits like a hand in a glove with what we have here. Now that the Wilmington Police Department with special divisions or just as a general policy, and again, you've got to credit the motion to dismiss that what they have done, and they don't dispute this, as on a motion to dismiss on the underlying claims, Fourth Amendment, 14th Amendment, Title VI, you've got to accept that as you make that in the other cases.
The core activity is representing people who have,
that the NAACP believes have some type of constitutional violation, in this case, going into the future. And that's what you do. Where do you go beyond that to establish a plus factor that might put you within the Ninth Circuit or the Fourth Circuit cases?
Because it means drawing the resources from the rest of the state, spending extra, not the lawsuit, extra time and effort in combating that underlying unconstitutional practice. That's the additional level. In the same way, the Republican National Committee has to spend efforts in trying to convince, right, to respond to voter fraud in North Carolina, to support Republican candidates. I think we have the same level of activity. Last point on Lyons, I will go back again. There's a huge difference between somebody who's committed a criminal act and then with this and as a chokehold, as opposed to all the cases we've cited in which we have totally innocent people, which means they're free to stop anybody. They don't have to look for a criminal act, and the repeat actions in those cases is sufficient to distinguish it from Lyons.
Thank you, Mr. Radovsky. We thank both counsel for the helpful briefing and oral argument. We'll take the matter under advisement and